Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 26th, 2010, and this is show number 279. Well, I've been having so much fun this week playing with my new MacBook Pro battery. I know, it does sound fun, doesn't it? Well, a couple weeks back, I tweeted out asking, why does my battery go from around 28% to zero in the blink of an eye? It died with no warning, no, gee, you might want to plug in soon or anything like that. Several people, I think it started with Kirshen first, suggested that one of the battery cells might have gone bad. I wanted to get independent confirmation, so I pinged the Mac Geek Gab boys, and Dave Hamilton said she was very likely right. When queried on how many cycles the battery had gone through, which is available, by the way, under System Profiler, I answered that it was 305. A collective Twitter shudder went through the crowd as they sadly explained that AppleCare lasts through 300 cycles. Undaunted and slightly encouraged by the mob, I went ahead and called AppleCare anyway. The first guy was lovely, and then he sent me to the battery expert, who upon learning that I was at 305 cycles, told me I was out of luck. I gently explained it had been going on for weeks, so it was probably under 300 when it started happening. He said, no dice. I explained that I had about 28 devices under paid AppleCare. Didn't that count for anything? He started getting snottier by this point, and in his most disdainful voice, he said, well, what do you want me to do? Give you a free replacement battery? To which I responded sweetly, yes, thank you. It was really odd, but he immediately processed the return while retaining his entire tude about the whole thing. And one day, I had a new battery, and I sent the other one back. I took a class a long time ago, by the way, where I learned this technique of simply chipping away at people until you'd swear they paid for the replacement, repair, comedy tickets, whatever it was you were trying to get them to give you, out of their very own pockets just to get rid of you. It works remarkably well. I simply didn't give up. I wasn't mean to him. I wasn't snotty. I just kept asking him questions until he was like, okay, fine, get rid of her. Okay, the point of the story, though, was that this new battery simply rocks. I know. If you've got one of the new MacBook Pros and or MacBooks, and they have those crazy good batteries that go like 7.5 days or whatever, you're thinking, what are you talking about? But let me tell you, even on a good day with a wind at my back when the battery was new on my MacBook Pro, I could barely make it through a two-hour movie without it dying. With this new battery, I played at Starbucks on Friday for an hour and 50 minutes, and I still had 28% of my battery power left. That was with full screen brightness and Wi-Fi on. I didn't used to be able to get through those movies with Wi-Fi off, Bluetooth off, the screen down to one little dot there, you know? So I am really, really happy I did stayed with my persistence and kept on with that guy until he gave me the free battery. Well, if you haven't been to a tweet up yet, I think you're missing something. Yesterday, Steve and I joined a tweet up in Tucson, but we did it via Skype. Now, that wasn't as good as being there for sure, but we got to see Melissa Davis, the Mac mommy, again, meet her son Keegan for the first time, and we got to meet Carell for the first time. She's a lot of fun in the chat room on the NoSilicast live show, but there was this really funny moment when they turned the camera towards her, and I said, so, who's this? And she said, it's me! I had to laugh since I'd neither heard her voice nor seen her face before, especially since she had cut her dreadlocks off and wasn't wearing a pirate costume like in her Twitter avatar. How was I supposed to know who me was? Well, next up, we got to meet one of our newer internet friends, Wade Gutman, a.k.a. Gutmosh on Twitter. You'll hear a review from him later in the show. And finally, David B. Moore, who has been a longtime NoSilicast way participating in the live show chat, and we've been emailing forever, so it was really fun to get to meet him, too. I took a couple of screenshots of our Skype window so you could see their smiling faces in the show notes. The way we did this was, is Melissa put her laptop on Keegan's stroller so she could rotate Steve and I around while we chatted with the people at the tweet-up. My only regret with this whole thing was that I've been feeling under the weather and I couldn't keep my energy up as long as I would have liked. But in the brief time we were on, we got to meet old friends for the first time. So next time you hear of a tweet-up in your area, go to it.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, this week I had a lovely out-of-control process running on my Mac that took my last precious 10 gigabytes of disk space away from me, leaving me with Zero. Not a couple of kilobytes. Zero. You can imagine how well my machine was running. Well, this happened in the course of just a few minutes. I mean, I had set aside 10 gigabytes of space the night before, and I turn around, boom, it's gone. Well, at the time that it first happened, it actually happened twice, I had not yet discovered the cause, so I was frantically searching for things to delete. I opened my email and I sorted it by size to see what I could dump. When lo and behold, I came across a voice recording from Dave from Oregon from November of last year that I never, ever answered. How rude am I? It was his first message ever to me, his first voice recording, and I ignored him. I felt like such a heel. I wrote back with my tail between my legs and I begged for his mercy. Well, he was just as nice as the first time when he wrote back and he forgave me. Well, let's hear his dumb question, which sadly has not been answered after 10 months.
Hi, Allison. This is Dave from Oregon, and I'm sending in my first dumb question. I hope the audio quality comes out all right. This is I'm not very experienced with these recordings, but thought I'd give it a shot. My question is this. I'm a teacher and went through a teacher education program, and we were really instructed thoroughly in using AppleWorks. Now, this has been years ago, of course, but we were instructed in using AppleWorks for word processing, for draw documents, paint documents, spreadsheets, the whole bit when AppleWorks was the program to use. And since then, of course, Apple has gone to the iWork suite, and I've converted nicely to the iWork suite, and I love the applications there. But here's my problem. Upon upgrading to Leopard, I was excited about the Quick Look feature. But the problem I'm having now is that Quick Look doesn't recognize my AppleWorks documents. And even though I've switched to Pages and switched to Numbers and switched to Keynote, I still have, you know, a wide range of documents that I've created in AppleWorks over the years that I use regularly. And it would be great to have that Quick Look functionality, but I can't seem to get it to work in AppleWorks. And I can't figure out a way. I haven't been able to come across anyone has a plugin or anything that will allow me to view that. So my dumb questions are, is it possible to do it? And if it's not, I'm just curious why it's not. So I hope you're able to use this recording. And thanks for the show. I love it. And I'll keep on tuning in. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, after all this time, I think the best thing I can suggest is to convert all of the text documents to pages. But it turns out you don't have to do it one by one exactly. I thought I might be able to come across a script to do it for you, and I didn't, I don't know, I found some stuff, but it looked kind of dodgy. But I did find several places that suggested selecting all of the documents at once, hopefully they're not spread all over Kingdom Come, and then right-clicking on one, selecting Open With, and then they're all going to come up on screen. And then save them out as pages documents. I put a link in the show notes to a discussion forum at macworld.com where a guy goes into more detail on how to do this as easily as possible. After the few front-end steps on the first file, he said it was a matter of hitting enter 50 times to save all those files out as pages files. I wish I had a better answer for you, and maybe someone in the chat room or somebody who's listening right now has a better answer, and I will definitely pass that along if somebody comes up with a better answer. But for now, let me know if this poor substitute of an answer is any use of it all to you. Well, I received another email that I wanted to ignore, not accidentally ignore, but I simply could not. It's from that ever-loving nitpicker, Quality Control Director Steve. Let me read it to you now. Allison, I heard rumors that Connor P. was attempting to usurp my position as quality control director. So in order to secure my authority, let me point out an egregious error on your part. In NoSilicast episode 278, you stated that Michelle, also known as Country Signs from theportablegamer.com, had never been on your show before. That just didn't sound right. I was sure she had sent in a review for your show. But I was wrong. Michelle hasn't been on the NoSilicast once before. She has appeared at least three times before. Shows 186, 234, and 269. Please note that prior to last week's, Michelle appeared on the NoSilicast as recently as July of this year. She may have actually sent in more reviews, but I got tired of searching when I realized how far off the mark you were. Point made. Disapprovingly, Quality Control Director Steve. As much as it pains me to admit it, you're entirely right. How could I have forgotten her review of Hazel just last July? As soon as you told me that, I realized I remember that review. Well, I'll try to do better, Steve. I really will. Well, this coming Saturday, I'm going to be speaking at the Orange Apple Computer Club, which you can find at oacc.org. And the event's going to be at the Orange Coast College in Costa Mesa. The subject is around how to create a podcast, but the club has already had an introductory lesson, so I'm going to take it up a notch and talk about how to create the live show. Of course, as usual, I procrastinated till the weekend before getting my notes together, because, you know, that's just pretty much how I roll. The good news is that I don't have to do hardly any work to create some keynote slides, because when I went on vacation, I created a Screen Steps tutorial for Katie Floyd so she could do the live show for me. Have I remembered to thank her lately for that? No? Thank you, Katie. It was awesome that you did that for us. Anyway, that's one of the great strengths of Screen Steps. It's not just that you can create a great tutorial with screenshots, annotations, and text explanations. It's that you get to reuse these tutorials. Bruce Baker asked if I had any material on how to do the live show, too. So instead of explaining it three separate times, I only had to do it once. If you find yourself answering the same questions on computer-based stuff over and over again, you really should check out the free trial of Screen Steps Desktop over at screensteps.com. After you realize how great it is, it's only $40 for the standard version or $80 for the pro version. But throw in my coupon code, NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, then you get to knock 25% off of that purchase price. Do it. Our next review is by Wade Gutman, a.k.a. Gutmosh, on Twitter, who I mentioned we got to meet at the Tucson Tweetup yesterday. He thought about doing an audio review for us, but he told me he has a learned speech pattern. He's partially deaf, you see, so he felt it might be a bit hard for us to understand the recording. Now, I don't normally like to read other people's reviews. It always sounds funny when I say things like, I think, or I felt, when I really meant they felt. But for Wade, I think we'll make an exception. He has a review of a service that allows you to get audiobooks for free called LibriVox. That's LibriVox. Here's what he says. The web address for the LibriVox audio collection is at LibriVox.org. Every LibriVox recording begins the same way. Quote, this is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. He says LibriVox.org gets their text from Project Gutenberg and all of the readers are volunteers. LibriVox.org was founded in 2005. He says, I have a file folder on my hard drive that I use to store all my LibriVox audiobooks in an MP3 format, such as History of the Christian Church, the First 600 Years, Thomas Paine's Common Sense, and my most recently completed The Three Musketeers. There's a playlist that I have within iTunes that fetches the audiobooks from that folder. With The Three Musketeers, there are about five different readers reading the chapters, 69 chapters in all, in the audiobook. Some of the readers acted out the roles of the characters in the audiobook, which made listening most enjoyable. As I'm partially deaf, I had to do some tweaking. Within Get Info, I had the equalizer preset set to spoken word and the media kind setting set to audiobook. I highly recommend that fellow Nocilla castaways take a look at LibriVox.org and check out the recordings, or even volunteer to become a reader. I wish that Bridget Regan, Mother Confessor Kalan's Legend of the Seeker series, would become a reader. She has an audiobook kind of voice. There you have it, my review. Sincerely, Wade Gutman, Tucson, Arizona. Well, thanks, Wade. That was really great. I've got to make sure that Nightwise hears about this because he loves free stuff. He's going to go crazy over this. And it was really, really nice meeting you at the tweet-up. I thought that was great fun finally getting to meet you. That was a good time.
Hi, Allison. This is Bruce Baker of BecomingMature.org with an heroic tale of disaster averted at Dulles International Airport. Let's start with a problem to be solved. Suppose you've known for months that a particular paper must, at all costs, be in the hands of a certain person at a time when you might be indisposed. Say, oh, I don't know, on an airplane. And let's suppose that this document is to be included on a CD to be passed out to attendees of an important conference where you're scheduled to present. Let's also imagine, for the sake of argument, that you did what you swore you wouldn't do and pushed back your editing of said paper to the last minute. As impossible as it is to conceive, this is the predicament in which I found myself. I stayed up very late the night before and finished most of the edits. I got up early and completed the rest of the edits just before I needed to check out of the hotel. Still, I was breathing a sigh of relief. I mean, as they say in Jamaica, no problem, man. All I had to do was email the document. Easy. I'm home free. Imagine then my consternation when I arrived at the gate of Ethiopian Airlines at Dulles International Airport and discovered that the Wi-Fi access that is freely available in the rest of the facility was nowhere to be found. Evidently, Ethiopian Airlines does just enough business to be stuck in the bowels of the terminal maze that is Washington Dulles Airport. But I digress. What was I to do? My iPhone had 3G access to AT&T's much maligned network, which has always worked perfectly for me, by the way. But the file was on my laptop. How was I to get the file from my laptop to my iPhone? I suppose if I had enabled tethering, there would have been no problem. But frankly, I've had no need for tethering or their monthly fee up until this point. So what to do? Well, there's several excellent solutions for this problem, such as MobileMe, Dropbox, Evernote, just to name a few. But all these fine products require Wi-Fi to sync to the cloud. Listen, cloud computing isn't all it's cracked up to be when you're stuck at a gate with no connectivity and a deadline barreling down at you like an overloaded semi. I tried printing the document to a PDF and then importing the PDF as a book into iTunes and syncing it with my iPhone. This got the file on my phone, but I couldn't figure out a way to get it out of the book reader to mail. Then I remembered an app that I'd installed quite some time ago but seldom used. It's called AirSharing by Avatron Software. While I have the Pro version at $6.99, they also have a regular version for $2.99. But for my needs, the Pro version was necessary. AirSharing performs a host of wondrous tasks, but the one that I eagerly searched for was the ability to mount my iPhone as a server on my laptop. Of course, this requires a Wi-Fi network. But wait, since I don't need a server located in the clouds, I could make my own network. Mac OS X allows a user to make a private network of their own. With the call to begin boarding booming over the public address, I went to the system preferences and created the network. Next, I connected the iPhone to the network I just created. AirSharing provides a static IP address to be used for mounting the drive. Using the Connect to Server menu in OS X, I quickly had my iPhone all dressed up as a hard drive on my desktop. Quick copy, and it was done. But wait. The only program that would access the file was AirSharing. Seems that they feel that since they created the hard drive, everything on it belongs to their program. Beads of perspiration dotted my furrowed brow as I prayed that the fine folks at Avatron included a mail document feature into their software. I actually let out a quite loud and completely involuntary yes, which turned more than a few startled heads when the comforting whoosh of sent mail was heard. Unlike the other passengers who endured with heavy sighs the long line to gain admittance to the aircraft, I was quite content as I shuffled toward the cattle chute and Rome. Now, if I could just find time to finish that presentation.
How totally awesome, Bruce. That was fantastic. I think this is a very, very clever solution. After hearing this, when you sent it in, I rushed right out and I bought AirSharing Pro just to have it in my tool belt, just in case. Now I have to figure out what all the other wondrous things that it is it can do. I did have an interesting problem, and I don't entirely think it's fault. I tried using the printing utility from it, which was kind of crazy cool, and I think I sent it to a printer that's not here anymore, and it caused the HP printer driver to just go berserk. Remember that part earlier where I explained that my disk space disappeared? That was the runaway process. When I left to do something, and I came back, and my processor was just going, you know, 100% in menu meters, and I took a look at it, and it said it was PhotoSmart was the problem. And it had a secondary process that said something about cups, which is the Unix print utility. I killed both of those, and all of a sudden, my 10 gigabytes of disk space came back. So it was interesting. I'm hoping I don't see it crop up again. I think it probably was because I had chosen a printer that didn't actually exist anymore. I hope so, because there was nothing in the printer list or the printer queue. So anyway, that looks very cool, and I'm going to have fun playing with AirSharing Pro.
Hey, Allison. Donald Burr of Adocano Podcast here with a review of an iPhone app called WorkLog. So ever since I got laid off from my corporate job last year, I've been making ends meet by doing odd computer consulting, web design, etc. type of jobs, which is fine, but that means I have to be accountable for all the time I spend with my various clients, and I have to keep really good records. Now, of course, I could keep these records on my computer, but I don't necessarily have my computer with me at all times. Also, some of the job sites don't let me bring computers in with me. But they do allow iPods, go figure. So I was looking for a solution that would work on my iPod Touch, and I believe I finally found one. A program called WorkLog by Cyclus, which works on both the iPhone and the iPod Touch, and presumably the iPad as well in compatibility mode. When you first start the program, it comes up with a large clock with a start and a stop button. Seems simple enough. Press start, and the clock starts counting your time. And press stop, and it stops. Now, I was worried because his Steve-ness decreed that no applications can run in the background. So I was worried what would happen if I, say, exited the app to change the song in iTunes, or if I needed to check my email or something. Good news, through some unknown method of trickery, the programmers of WorkLog were able to account for the time that you spend outside of the app, so in effect, the clock keeps running until you press the stop button. The program keeps a log of all of your clock-ins and clock-outs. That log can be viewed underneath the clock display. Tapping any of these entries will let you adjust the time. Say maybe you forgot to clock in until maybe half an hour after you started working, or maybe you forgot to clock out for lunch, that sort of thing. Also, you can manually create time entries. So one of the first things I did was go through my old paper time logs and try and decipher my Egyptian hieroglyphics and enter in all of my time data. The program can be configured to either keep track of time exactly, minute by minute, second by second, or you can have it round up, say, round up to the nearest 15 minutes or round up to the nearest half an hour. Now, for each time entry, you can set a client as well as add a note. Say, for example, from 11 o'clock to 1:30, I worked for Allison Sheridan and I fixed her website. Now, what do you do with all of this data when it comes time to send out the bills? Good news, you can easily generate and view reports on the device by date range. This week, last week, this month, last month, or a custom date range. This is very flexible. But what's even better is you can actually export this data to your computer in the form of a CSV file, a comma-separated value file. These files are commonly used with spreadsheet programs such as Allison's beloved Microsoft Excel or Apple's Numbers. So that way you can easily import your data into Excel or whatever you use and print out cool-looking reports. The program can be set to either email the reports to yourself from the iPhone or iPod Touch, or you can do some weird convoluted thing where you actually run a little web server on your iPod and connect to it over Wi-Fi from your computer. Believe it or not, that's a little too geeky even for me. I just use the email method. It's easier. What I like about this program is that it's pretty simple. It does exactly what I need. It's got a good set of features. It's very flexible in terms of categorizing the time that you spend. And it has some nice exporting options. What I don't like about this program is that the UI is sometimes a little clumsy feeling. Activate a certain feature or to set a certain option sometimes takes more screen taps than I think may be absolutely necessary. Some UI refactoring may be a good idea on the part of the developer. It also would be nice to be able to generate a report by category or by client rather than by date. Say I want to see all the time that I spent with Phil or all of the time that I spent with Susan as opposed to everything I did this past month. Also, when it outputs CSV files, it outputs them in kind of a strange format. In the program's options, there's actually two choices. You can either output it in Microsoft format or standard format. Now, I'd wager that Microsoft format would work perfectly with Excel. Unfortunately, I use numbers, and it kind of didn't work for me. So when I switched the output mode to standard, it worked fine. Of course, I had to get really geeky and actually hack together a little Perl script that reads that output file and generates reports and emails them to the clients all in one go. I'm such a geek. Speaking about the settings panel for this program, I couldn't find it. There's no settings button or something in the menu bar of the program. Turns out that the settings page is actually in the iPod Touch's settings application. Apparently, this is the place where Apple wants all of its developers to put their settings pages, so hopefully all other developers will follow suit soon. And finally, at $4.99, some people may think this app is a bit much for what it does. Me? I don't think so. I mean, for crying out loud, that's like two Starbucks, so just go without your coffee for a day or two, and you'll pay for it already. And they do offer an LT, or light version, that's free, and that has all of the features of the standard version, but only keeps 3 days' worth of data, so that way you can easily try before you buy. All in all, I'm really satisfied with this program. It does everything I need, and it works. And it's so much better than paper. Ugh. Check it out at the links that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Hey, Donald, as always, a fantastic review. I really love how well you stay to the problem-to-be-solved program. I might just use something like this. I use a really old program called Mac Freelance that hasn't been updated since 2007. You know, it's okay, and it gets the job done, but it's not mobile, and the interface is really confusing. It's almost like I have to relearn it every month when I do my billings for stuff. So anyway, I might go check out Worklog. Next up, let's hear from Nightwise.
Hello, Allison. Nightwise from Nightwise.com calling with a little review. Well, as it is with most reviews, we need to have a problem first. The problem is you want to listen to your favorite podcasts while going to work. I have done so. I have put on my earbuds, I have put my iPod in my pocket, and I have walked to work. As I walk to work, I can listen to my podcasts hands-free, and it's very nice. The only downside is I live about 100 miles from where I work, and it takes me the better part of the week to get there, and then I need to get back again. Not very convenient. Also, when it rains, snows, or storms, I get wet, snowed in, or blown away. Well, mostly. Or when the sun shines really, really bright, I get really, really hot. It's not very pleasant. So it got me thinking, wouldn't it be cool to have a device that would be like an iPod dock, but with wheels and an engine? Well, believe it or not, Ford has invented such a device. It is called an automobile. In this case of this review, a Ford Focus Clipper Econetic. Now, I know most of you are saying, Nightwise, why are we talking about cars on the NoSillaCast? Well, because I just got a brand spanking new one from work, and I want to tell everybody about it. Well, why the Ford Focus Clipper Econetic? Why is it different of any other car? It doesn't come with Honda Bob service. It's not a Honda or an Acura. It doesn't have a massive horn. It doesn't tell bad jokes, although I think the people at the garage could make a good crack at that one, too. I mean, why are we talking about this? We're not going to talk about the very fuel-efficient engine that only kind of does 5 liters in 100 kilometers, which makes it super fuel-efficient. We're not going to talk about the sleek lines and the tainted windows and the fact that it has a giant Autobot sticker on the rear windshield. No, we are going to talk about the tech inside. Yep, I got to just choose about every little gadgety doohickey that came with this little car. Well, little, with this car. And I want to tell you about all the tech that came with it. First of all, it comes with a center console with a built-in navigational system, a GPS. Well, not very sensational, apart from the fact that, you know, the voice kind of sounds like Rachel Barrett from Star Trek, but okay, that's okay. It also has a CD player. Who uses that anymore? But the central console underneath my arm here, underneath my elbow, does have a USB port that lets you plug in an external USB stick or an external hard drive, which then you can control via the radio console, play the MP3s that are on there. It also comes with a line-in connector, which lets you plug in just about any auxiliary device that you want to with an analog 3.5mm mini jack. If you still have that Zoom, yeah, that's what it's for. So that's all pretty convenient, but it also comes with Bluetooth technology. And that Bluetooth technology is not very impressive. Most cars have that. I mean, you have a Bluetooth-enabled phone, you hop into the car, and the car says, well, hey, there's a phone in the car. Do you want me to play hands-free headset for you, hands-free set for you? Well, yes, you can. And when somebody calls, you can just throw them on the speaker system, which is a 5.1 speaker system with a friggin' subwoofer. This is a car, people. This is a run-of-the-mill, off, out-of-the-shop car. But never mind. So it has a Bluetooth connection, which turns the car into a hands-free set. It can also interact with your phone book via Bluetooth. So that's pretty cool. But what else it does is it acts as a Bluetooth speaker set. So imagine my surprise when I hopped into this car with my iPhone and I had Bluetooth activated because I thought, well, then I can use it as a hands-free set. But suddenly the iPhone said, like, hey, these are a pair of Bluetooth speakers. It connected to the speakers in the car and started playing the podcast immediately. So whenever I'm in the car, I can wirelessly listen to my podcast over the speakers using the stereo Bluetooth connection, which sounds freaking awesome. But when I get out of the car, the iPhone immediately loses the connection with the speakers, thus halts the podcast into pause mode and doesn't continue playing, so I miss things. Now, when I am outside, at work, I play around with my iPod a little bit, with my iPhone, and I put on a different song. And then I hop back into the car. Now, guess what? Either the car or the iPhone actually remembers the track that was playing when I got out of the car and picks up where I left off. Now, the first few times when I didn't expect this, I was very much kind of scared when suddenly I heard, my favorite podcast just started playing. But it's an awesome, awesome little device. Now, if you don't like fumbling buttons when you're driving, I mean, who fumbles buttons in the car when he's driving? Those would be insane people. Those would be the people who would actually, record podcasts while driving or audio commentary. You don't do that. That's dangerous. But it's also voice activated. You can activate the radio, you can activate the phone, and you can activate the navigation via voice command. And I think I can show you how that sounds. Let me see here. Help.
Help. After the tone, please select either phone, radio, CD player, external device, or directly select dial number, dial name, or store name.
Cancel.
Command cancelled.
Awesome, isn't it? I mean, she's so very British and she's so very well-spoken. Very cool device. But what it also does, and that is going to round up this device, this little review of this awesome driving iPod dock, is this. Tea, Earl Grey, hot. There you go.
Earl. Radio.
No, not radio. I want tea. Tea, Earl Grey, hot. Cancel.
Directory empty.
No, no, I want tea, not directory. Oh, bugger. Well, it doesn't work 100% of the... It doesn't work 100% of the time, but it's okay. So I hope you enjoyed my little
device,
review.
Please.
No, shut the... No, cancel. 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 It's not 100% yet. It doesn't make tea.
Command canceled.
It made me a blueberry muffin. The replicator just made me a blueberry muffin. Well, whatever. Go to nightwise.com, KNIGHTWISE.com, and you'll see the blueberry muffin that my Ford Focus replicator car made. Awesome device and a real great iPod dock. T, Earl Grey, hot. Cancel?
Command cancel.
Oh, forget it.
Only you, Nightwise, can find a way to work a Ford Focus into a Nosilicast gadget review. You did an admirable job of it, though. I must admit I'm jealous of all the gadgets you got in that thing. I don't even get a stinking iPod dock in my Acura TL. It does have Bluetooth, but not really good Bluetooth stuff. Basically, I can answer the phone and make phone calls, but I can't dial anybody's number. Well, anyway, if the listeners would like to hear any more of K-Dub's nonsense, check out his podcast, The Nightcast, over at nightwise.com. Now, I'm afraid I may never own a Ford Focus iPod dock, because if I did, I'd have to give up Honda Bob. And let me tell you, that just ain't going to happen. If I didn't drive a Honda or an Acura, Bob wouldn't drive to my house, do the maintenance and very infrequent repairs while I sat inside and played on my computer. All right, I'm lying to you. I don't actually sit inside most of the time. Usually Bob and I compare iPhone apps, iPad apps, discuss cabling of our devices, play with computer applications, and somehow in there he manages to work on our cars too. If you'd like to have a true geek come to your house, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, you're expecting the chit-chat across the pond music right now, but before we get into that, I want to explain that both Bart and I are a little teeny bit under the weather. I don't know if it was the medication, the sickness, or some sort of generalized brain fart on our collective parts, but just a bit of this is an almost word-for-word duplicate to some things we said last week. Certainly not all of it, just some pieces of it. It was supposed to be a follow-up to last week, but I know that at least I said a few things exactly as I said them the week before. So put your pencils down, Connor and Steve. I already apologized. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. And Bart and I are joining you here from the tuberculosis ward because we're both sick as dogs.
Yeah, obviously, you know, viruses can spread over the internet.
Apparently. Well, I've heard that, you know. Yes, but the show must go on as always, right?
Absolutely.
We're little
proper
troopers.
Showbiz stuff here.
You betcha. We'll try to be our normal, delightful, entertaining selves. So
it's getting harder on week three of being sick, but okay.
Yeah, I'm a novice at this being week one for me. So anyway, let's start. What's better to start off with than a little security light? What's been happening this week, Bart?
Okay, so last week we talked about Adobe being about to release an update to Flash. Well, they've released said update to Flash.
Ah, that's good. So we should all update our Flash?
We should all update our Flash. Slightly disappointingly, I know that apparently on Windows, Flash now tells you when it's out of date, but on the Mac, that didn't happen, so I guess the Mac version of Flash still lags behind, so it's still up to us to keep checking, rather than, which is, I don't know, talk about going back to the 1990s.
Yeah, really, that does sound old.
Yeah, but anyway, so update your Flash. It's quite an important update. It is being attacked in the wild, so definitely not one I dawdle with.
Yeah. You know, I forgot to go look for that. I should probably not do it right now because it would make me shut down my browser, huh?
Yes, it would. So best not. Then our friends Apple have also released a very unusual update for them. This file is literally just a few K. It's Security Update 2010-006, and it addresses one single flaw.
Hmm? One flaw?
Yeah, it's the first time I've seen Apple release a single issue update like this. Normally they build them up for a while and then release a big blob of them. But obviously they thought this one was serious enough that they put it out on its own. So
yikes.
It was an issue with the Apple File Sharing Protocol, AFP. And if you knew the username of the person's machine you were trying to connect to, you could connect without a password.
That's not good.
It's not good. You had to know the username, which is a teeny, tiny little amount of protection. But
not
yeah,
much.
So I guess I can... Exactly. So I can see why Apple pushed this one out on its own. And we should be thankful to them.
Yeah, yeah. And people hadn't been exploiting it yet, I guess?
I certainly hadn't heard of any such thing happening, so maybe Apple knows something we don't, but I certainly never heard of it being used.
Good. Wow.
So
okay.
I need to be more positive about Apple. Yeah, normally Apple are not like this, so this is good. Let's see more of this, please.
Yeah, definitely.
That's it.
That's it?
Yeah, a very light security light.
I guess so. Now, you had one other thing that you were... we were going to talk a little bit about what happened with Twitter this week.
Well, I thought people might be interested to understand what it was that actually happened. So Twitter is a website where users get to add content, which is always an inherently dangerous thing. The web browser can't differentiate between something that was written by Twitter and something that was added by the users. So if the users can somehow get some JavaScript into their posts, then that JavaScript will execute as if it had been written by Twitter with all the appropriate permissions of Twitter.com.
Oh.
And that means that the JavaScript can do anything you can do. So the JavaScript can post tweets, the JavaScript can friend people, the JavaScript can unfriend people. Basically, JavaScript can do anything that you could do on Twitter.com, which is not good. So what happened in this case was someone discovered a flaw where you could trick the website into rendering JavaScript by throwing in an at symbol at an improper place. So Twitter don't use a normal HTML parsing tool for stripping out the HTML from your tweets because they also have special stuff in there to make, you know, people's usernames into links and so forth.
Right.
And there was a mistake in their custom parser, which meant that if you threw in the at symbol in the wrong place, the thing got completely confused and just sort of stopped doing its job and out popped the JavaScript.
Huh. That's pretty clever to pull off in 140 characters.
It is, but people were doing very creative things with it.
Now, I thought the first guy who did it was actually not actually trying to be nefarious. Is that right?
Yes, the first guy who did it, apparently he had submitted it to Twitter 2 months before and never got anything back, so he just posted it. Which I guess is somewhat reasonable to do, because if he could discover it, surely the bad guys could too. So eventually you'd sort of have to go public with these things if the company is just unresponsive.
Right.
Twitter then became quite responsive. Because a young chap, I believe he was in Australia, I'm not 100% sure of that, but so the first guy just made it so that it would black out your tweet, and then you'd go to hover the mouse over it, which would trigger the unhover JavaScript event handler, which is where the code was hidden. And then it would, I think it would change your tweets into different colors. I think it was like Rainbow Tweet was the nickname people were giving it.
Okay.
Which didn't do anything any harm. It was just kind of funny. But the young guy, I think it was Australia, decided to take it a step further and use it to post a tweet of itself, which made it into a worm. It was now a virus to spread itself because every time someone would hover over one of these tweets, it would tweet itself out. Then another person would hover over it and it would tweet itself out again, and the whole thing just went exponential very quickly.
Oh. Now, the iPad doesn't have hover over, so you could have gone to it on the iPad or the iPhone or any iOS device and it wouldn't have happened, right?
It wouldn't have happened by hovering, but you could have maybe used the on-click handler or something so that if someone happened to tap on a tweet, I mean, this, or maybe inject it into onload or something. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can make JavaScript run. So the on-hover was how the first exploit was done, so that's what people tended to do. But once you can get JavaScript in there, you can be very creative about how it gets to run.
So in the vein of Security Light, this problem got fixed reasonably rapidly within, would you say, 8 hours?
It was within 6 or 8 hours, something like that. Now, it possibly would have been fixed even quicker, but it started in Japan, which is obviously a very different time zone to Twitter HQ. So all the Twitter people were in bed while this thing started to spread, and then they got up to find a whole big mess.
Well, I'm sure they probably were alerted earlier than when they woke up, don't you think?
But they may have been woken up, yeah.
Yeah, awakened by that problem. But from a Security Light perspective, what could we have done about it? If it was going on right now, what could we do?
Well, one thing is if you're not using a web browser, then all of this web browser-related stuff can't happen.
Right.
So but
there are times, right. But there are times when going to Twitter.com is handy, like when you're managing lists or things like that, or you're trying to do some advanced searches. You know, it's easier in some cases to deal with the web interface. So let's say I needed the web interface that day.
Well, in the past, you would have been able to use NoScript to protect yourself from these kind of things.
Oh,
but
not
at this
with
stage.
NoScript.
Yeah, well, yeah. And to be honest, I have NoScript blocking, or I had NoScript blocking Flickr or Twitter.
But see,
because
I
this is not
trusted
the first time
it.
This has happened.
I would have. There's no way if I were running JavaScript or NoScript that I would have thought, well, this is a dodgy site. I better not trust it. I would have thought, yeah, this is a known site by real people that do a real job and provide a service, and it's not dodgy in any way. So I would have said, sure.
Yeah, except for the fact that this is not the first time this has happened to Twitter.
Okay, but
this
before
the first
time, it wouldn't have saved you.
right?
No, but after the first time I started putting it in. Because I figured this shows that Twitter aren't on the ball, therefore I don't trust them. Now we have a new problem, though, because the new version of Twitter is so heavily reliant on Ajax that if you turn off JavaScript, you have nothing. So the NoScript option is gone.
Oh. So when they fixed it, they took away the...
Well, no. There's a new version of Twitter that's being pushed out to people. It's not everywhere yet, but it's coming.
Oh, yeah. Okay, the new one that allows like stuff to slide out that looks more like the Twitter client.
Yeah, that's JavaScript 100% all the way through. So if you disable JavaScript, you're left with nothing.
I can't wait to get that because I love it. I love that interface on the iPhone and the iPod Touch or on the iPad. It's really, really nice.
Yeah, I'm not giving up my client. I don't want to have my Twitter lost amidst 20 squillion tabs.
Say again?
So I don't want to have my Twitter lost amidst all the millions of tabs I always have open in my browser. Which is why I use client. It keeps it all nice and separate.
Oh, sure. But there, like I said, there are times when you need to go to a browser. I do when I'm on a different machine or something that maybe doesn't have Twitter loaded and I want to check something.
Yeah, I guess. So basically, we can't really protect ourselves in the future. So this could happen, and that's just that.
Okay. So I think this week we wanted to talk a little bit, you and I have been talking offline about what's going on with tablets, looking at the near future and what kind of stuff is out here. And we've talked briefly around that a little bit in the past, but I think we wanted to dig in a little bit more.
Yeah, I suppose there was two videos that sort of did the rounds this week that sort of got us talking about this. The one that caught my eye was a demo, was an unofficial demo video of the reported HP Slate that's due out soon. It's not an official video, so it's conceivable that it's a forgery, but goodness me, it would be a very impressive forgery.
Yeah, because it's a live demo and the guy's got it like sitting on a bed when he opens it and points at it and shows you all the parts of it. I mean, if it isn't, they built something to look like a slate. I mean, it's a physical thing, right?
It's a physical thing, and the fit and finish of all the buttons and the very strange material on the back and stuff, it looks awfully elaborate to be a fake.
Yeah, the guy who did that's probably fired from whatever company he was working for.
Yeah.
If it was HP, I guess.
Yeah. So it was interesting. So it was a sort of a quick demo showing around the hardware, showing the various buttons, and then turning it on, watching it boot, and then browsing the web with it. Mm-hmm. Now, this thing is running regular Windows 7. So that immediately gets you to the point where you're going, this actually looks awfully like a hack, because my big, fat, untransparent finger is quite different to a small, pointy mouse, which is what Windows was designed for. So even watching him click to open the browser, he was clicking on the new dock-like thing on the bottom of Windows, and he had to be very careful to click on the right thing, because those icons are just too small.
Yeah.
Notice he didn't go for the start menu, because he wouldn't have had a hope in hell.
It just looked sad.
Like a hack.
It looked kind of sad, didn't it?
It really looked like a hack, and then the hack gets even better, because unlike iOS, Windows has no particular notion of when a keyboard is and when a keyboard isn't required, because you use keyboards for all sorts of things.
Yeah. So tell me what happens when you want to use the keyboard.
There's a hardware button to make the keyboard come and go. Because it has no way to know when you need it and when you don't. Because Windows is driven by keyboard shortcuts for all sorts of things, so you can't say, only show the keyboard if I click in a text box.
Oh, right. Because it just doesn't know about those things.
Yeah, it's a desktop OS. It has no notion that there should be a time when there is no keyboard.
But that
doesn't make sense to a desktop.
Windows 7 operating system was created for touch too, though, right? Because they've got touch machines that you touch the screen to do stuff. But I guess the hardware
keyboard
is always
mouse,
there. Yeah.
So you can touch the screen to grab and swipe things on occasion, but it's not designed to be driven 100% by touch.
True.
It's like Superman, no one can do that. So it's very clunky for a start. But then he fired up Internet Explorer, and first thing you'll notice is, of course, oh, look, there's a Flash ad, which you may think for a moment is great. Right up to the point where he goes to scroll the screen. And it's jerky and very unresponsive. And then at one point, he has to tap a few times to get it to go anywhere, and then he ends up selecting the text on the page instead.
I just felt sorry for them when watching this.
The voiceover is the guy going, and look, it scrolls nicely, but the guy obviously is looking at something else than what he's describing, because it scrolled horribly. I mean, he was being so deliberate with all his pushes and his clicks and stuff to try to do things. It was painful to watch. This is such a clunky, unpolished experience, and I guess that's kind of what happens when you hammer a desktop OS into an underpowered flat computer with no keyboard or mouse.
But now HP owns the WebOS. They could have done a WebOS. Maybe it's just too soon for them to come out with a WebOS version.
I would guess that's the only possible logic. They were probably working on the Windows version before they acquired Palm. From what I understand, this Windows-based one is only going to be available to enterprises. It's not going to be shipped as a consumer product.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And I guess, as I was chatting to this with Stu Helm as well, and we were thinking that maybe, you know, if you're an IT manager, it might look very good on a product matrix. Windows 7, check.
Right.
So it probably checks all the boxes on a... It looks great on some PowerPoint slide somewhere, and companies are going to buy these things.
Look, it's just like the iPad, only it's Windows 7. That's perfect.
Yeah, we have all the tools we need to run that. Absolutely spot on. Check. Big smile until people start using it and realize it's horrible. Well, look, so it may actually sell quite well for a while.
Yeah, until they start using it.
Long-term future, yeah.
Well, let's start talking about something more fun in the galaxy space. That's not what I meant to say. In the tablet space. I gave it away.
Yeah, actually, just before we move on, just one thing to say. As I understand that the current state of the rumor mill, and I'm not sure how much of this is rumor and how much of this is official, but I do believe that the there is a WebOS tab on the way from HP.
Yay! That
so
might be
that's
fun.
Good news.
I haven't seen it, but it's got to be better, right?
Exactly, because at least WebOS was designed to be used by fingers, not by mice and keyboards. So it can only get better. I guess that's actually a good thing to take away from this. Things can only get better.
Right.
So
right.
Anyway, moving on to what was chronologically... So I showed you the HP Slate video and we both mocked it immensely. Mm-hmm. Actually, we skipped over the fact that it has a hardware control alt delete button. For when it invariably freezes, I guess.
Come on, I'm sick. Don't make me laugh like that, Bert. Really?
A control alt delete? According to the guy's video, he pointed at a button and went, and that's the control alt delete button.
Oh, my God.
Which he said, for the task manager, I believe, is how he phrased it.
Oh, it just... It's so sad.
It is. To be honest, when I first heard about the video, I thought it was a fake because of this control alt delete button, but it looks bloody real.
Oh, man.
I hope he's wrong. Maybe he just misread. Maybe
yeah.
That does something else.
Yeah, that's it.
We can hope. Anyhow, so after we looked at that video and mocked it for a while, you showed me the official video from Samsung showing off the Galaxy Tab.
Right.
And this is not rumor. This is not in any way unofficial. This is a genuine demo video released by Samsung to show off their new tablet. And the contrast is rather stark.
Before we get too far into it, one of the problems I have with Samsung, though, is they're calling everything a Galaxy. So when Nightwise was saying that he was having trouble deciding between getting a Galaxy and an iPhone 4, I thought he was talking about the tablet. In fact, they might be called the Galaxy S. I think they use the same name.
There's the Galaxy Tab and the Galaxy S. I think the Galaxy S is the smartphone and the Galaxy Tab is the tablet.
Maybe.
I guess they're basing their... I mean, it's a small tablet. It's only 7 inches. So it's much more like a sort of slightly expanded phone than the iPad.
Hmm.
So maybe they're very similar OS-wise and stuff. So maybe they're trying to build up a brand.
Hmm. By the way, I just went to look it up to see whether it was called the Galaxy S or not. And the entire site for the Galaxy Tab is a Flash video. Is Flash. There's nothing on the screen but Flash. I'm going to punish them and not play it. Okay. So anyway, we did like the Galaxy Tab, though. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, and the music on the video is horrific, and it did my head in. But other than that, the actual demo, the thing looked responsive, snappy. The interface was clean. Nice, big, clear icons. Very finger-friendly. As I say, beautifully responsive. Some of the interfaces looked strikingly familiar to iPad users.
Which I say, you know, steal the best parts. I'm fine with it.
To be honest, the parts that look quote-unquote stolen are the parts that are modeled on the real world. The diary in iOS looks like a diary. And the diary on this tablet looked like a diary. The bookshelf looked like a bookshelf.
What's a diary?
Calendar.
Calendar. Oh, okay. We don't use that word for that. A diary is something a teenage girl writes about her boyfriend.
Ah, okay. Here it's either that or a book into which you write your appointments.
Ah, okay.
Anyhow, so, you know, the bits that looked very familiar were based on very real-world metaphors, so maybe it's not surprising that they look familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all right.
And like you say, there's no harm in copying the best stuff from everyone. That's how consumers win.
Right. As long as it's not copyrighted, I guess I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar, not identical.
Now, this tablet is quite a bit smaller. It's 7 inches versus, what is the iPad is 9.7, I think?
Yeah, it's close to 10. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's 9 point something. Everyone describes it as 10.
So what do you think of 7 inches? Does size matter?
Yeah, actually. I'm a screen real estate fan. I have a 17-inch. Yeah. I have a 17-inch laptop, so I like having space on the screen. I hate low-resolution displays. It drives me mental. So 7 inches, it's a bit small. But the other thing is, in the demo, the guy holds it in one hand. He sort of straddles his hand around it. It doesn't look comfortable, like, at all, unless you were a concert pianist with giant hands. But anyway, so the size is a bit worrying, but maybe people will like it. To me, it reminds me of the problem I used to have with the old Palm Pilots. Too small, really, to use very well because you want a bit more screen real estate, but not small enough to fit in your pocket. So all trade-offs and no win.
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder, I have a feeling, and this sounds very sexist to say, but I have a feeling that the tablet form factor might really... is either going to benefit women more than men, or men are going to begin to finally carry purses and be done with it. Because it's, you know, you can't carry an iPad around if you don't have a purse. not practically on a day-to-day basis everywhere you go.
That's what your briefcase is for, obviously.
Yeah, I suppose.
You take out all the papers, you stick it in your iPad, and off you go.
But, you know, you go into the gym, you don't carry your briefcase, right? You go in, you know, you go into the grocery store, you don't carry your briefcase, but you do carry your purse. So,
I guess maybe men will start carrying a backpack or something. I don't know.
Because for God's sake, they won't call it a purse.
Just some sort of satchel or something.
I am so proud of my brother Grant. He refers to his fanny pack as his purse. And his wife goes, no, it's a fanny pack. And he goes, honey, it's a purse. Come on. I got my chapstick in there. I got my keys. I got my phone. You know, it's a purse. Get over it. He's fine about it. So... but now you start talking about 7 inches, that would fit in just about any, you know, practical woman's purse, where the 10-inch iPad, I could cram it in my old one, but I had to get a different purse in order to carry it comfortably. So 7 inches, maybe it would be easier to carry.
Okay, so that might, that's one possible way the size could be a benefit, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess that's just such an alien world to me, it just never occurred to me.
Well, it is good to make these comparisons. I know at work they went through an effort to try to think about how women carry things, because they were always going out of the way to get, you know, the belt clip for devices. And it's like, you know, I haven't worn a belt in about 20 years. I don't know what the belt clip's even for. You can put it in your pocket. I don't have pockets either, the way I wear my clothes. So they started looking at, well, what would a woman like to carry in terms of a bag for her computer? So they actually started giving us, you know, fancy pants, pretty little things with flowers on them and crap. So, but it's good, you know, because it is a different need.
Yeah.
I would really like to see one in person. And now you've got the other end of the spectrum with like this Streak. The Dell Streak is what, like 5 inches or something like that?
Yeah, that's even smaller. And that's... that thing looks like someone, I don't know, like an oversized phone, sort of a comedy phone.
It is 5 inches. Yeah, and that is actually a phone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely too small.
Yeah.
And too big, because that will not fit in my pocket, and a phone really has to fit in your pocket.
Now, what about pricing on the Galaxy Tab?
I'm not sure how official the prices are yet. I think the Germany price may actually be official. And if it is, it's not a good price.
What was it?
It was €800. For the 16 gig model.
What is that in real numbers?
800? I think someone said it was about $1,000.
Jeez. Yeah, it's $1,077 right now.
16 gigs, remember?
It's for 16 gigs, so more than twice. Holy cow, what are they thinking?
Well, now what they're thinking is that this thing is going to be sold with contract so that you get it subsidized. So they're looking at this thing as a giant phone.
But see, that's where they've missed the boat. If Apple had not done a contractless deal with AT&T, they could get away with that. But Apple already broke the barrier. So now you can $500 is $500. You know, you don't have to, or well, $639, I guess, if you're talking a 3G.
And and those of us who have no interest in having yet another 3G device have a Wi-Fi option. I don't believe that exists for the Galaxy.
Oh, there's no Wi-Fi only version?
Not that I'm aware of, but I guess that may change between now and launch day. I mean, they may see sense.
See, I still don't understand how you could buy a would want a device. Well, I guess in that case, that's my fault. But why someone would want the Wi-Fi only version? I mean, I think there are people in their lives who have Wi-Fi everywhere they go, but I sure am not one of them.
Works out well for me.
I only have Wi-Fi at home.
Yeah, the places I use the iPad, it works out fine.
Yeah,
I can count on one hand if I can. If to be honest, I can't think of a single instance where I missed 3G on the iPad.
Wow. Yeah, if I had Wi-Fi at work, that would be awesome. But I don't.
Yeah, I do.
Actually, I have the worst of both worlds. I have the worst of both worlds. I have a Wi-Fi network that I can't connect to, and the iPad keeps trying to connect to it. Even though I told it to forget this network, don't even look at this network, that network is not the one you're looking for, it constantly pings, and I can see the meter dropping on the battery life. If I forget to turn it off, by the time I go home, the iPad's at like 20% battery life from full. It's ridiculous. I have to turn it off every day, and I can't stop it from doing it.
Wow.
I need somebody else to look at it and see maybe I'm missing something and how I'm telling it to, you know, quit it.
Yeah, maybe I might have a gander at the settings later. But, I don't know. By Apple having a 16-gig device with no strings attached whatsoever, basically the Wi-Fi iPad for about $500, which, you know, in Europe it sells about €500.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a million miles away from being half the price of the Samsung one.
That does not make any sense. I don't. It's like they're trying to kill it. Oh, one other thing. Doesn't it look really thick? I think it's because it's 7 inches, but how thick is that thing? It looks like it's like, you know, as thick as a paperback book.
It's probably no thicker than the iPad in its thickest place, because the iPad, of course, cheats in that wonderful Apple way of being very thin, artificially thin at the edges and quite bulgy in the middle.
I love that.
Yeah, so it's playing with your head, the iPad. The iPad isn't as thin as you think it is. And then because you've shrunk down the tablet and in your brain you're seeing something the size of an iPad, you scale up the thickness too. So I think the Galaxy loses twice.
Yeah.
So it's got, you know, the iPad wins based on an optical illusion and the Galaxy Pad loses based on an optical illusion. So,
but you would think maybe they could make it proportionally thinner, but they didn't.
No. That actually is probably harder, to be honest, because they have to get a lot of battery in there, just like Apple did. But Apple were able to spread that battery over 10 inches worth of screen.
Yeah. Good point.
Because the iPad, when you see a teardown of it, it's basically a battery with a screen and a few other components.
They shouldn't need as much battery since they're not pumping out as much watts or whatever, right? Because the screen's smaller too, though.
That'll save them a little battery, but you know, it's
not
a 3G device.
Probably.
Yeah, it's a 3G device. And if you're trying to beat the iPad's immense 12-hour or 10-hour battery life, whatever it is officially, you're going to really have to do well on your battery. So obviously we don't know things like that from this demo.
Right. Well, I think one thing I would like to say, though, is that I'm not against in any way cool Android or whatever webOS tablets coming out. And I think the competition here can be really, really fun. My ideal scenario is that all these companies get together and they make these killer devices that make Apple have to run faster, but Apple still wins.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to be beating Apple, but I want everybody to push them so we get cooler and cooler stuff.
Which is what we all hoped that the Zune would do.
Poor Zune. Well, you know, my buddy Ron was talking about it last night. He said, you know, the Apple was a game changer with the MP3 players, with the iPods originally, and then they were a game changer with the iPhones. And you realize that all these cool Android phones that are out there probably would not exist, and I'm going out on a limb here and might piss off the Android lovers, but...
No, no, I'll back up your limb in a moment.
They don't... you hold the limb steady. That they might not exist in the form they are today if they hadn't seen what Apple did, because, I mean, if they were going to, why didn't they do it before Apple? Because so many of the features you look at, they look a lot like it, and that's great.
Yeah.
But Apple started it.
I can back it up even more, because Android predated iOS, predated the iPhone revolution. And there are diagrams of the old designs for Android phones.
Did they look
really? Like BlackBerry.
Yep. Android predated iOS?
Yes. Within Google. It wasn't, there was nothing about it public, but within Google it was being worked on.
Oh.
And there are diagrams of the phones they were working on. Their prototype phones for their OS. They were BlackBerry clones.
Okay.
Small screen, keyboard.
Hmm.
Lots and lots and lots of buttons. And then the iPhone came out, became a complete revolution, and they did a U-turn, and they produced a very iOS-like OS.
Hmm.
So I would say you would be very, very hard-pushed to argue that Apple did not revolutionize the entire mobile phone world.
Right. Well, and let's I don't think that's for tablets, right?
And they're doing it with tablets because the big thing was the netbook. It was going to be the revolution. You know, I never... ever understood the point of netbooks. Yes, they're cheap, but they are compromise, compromise, and compromise.
Maybe, though, that they were a necessary stepping stone to see, you know, sometimes a misstep is what tells you what the right answer is.
I think they were sort of a symptom that there was a problem that needed solving.
Yeah, right.
People wanted something small and portable to do email and web.
Right.
And the netbook was the first attempt at solving that need. It was a clunky attempt. Now, the iPad comes in and it nails it.
Yeah.
And now other people are saying, aha, Apple are onto something here. After initially ridiculing Apple, saying the thing would never take off, then they get in line behind it. That's sort of the way these things go. I mean, Steve Ballmer loves ridiculing Apple and how the iPhone, what do Apple know about mobile phones? This thing is going nowhere. This thing has no future. Ha 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 ha. Fast forward 4 years and he looks like a moron.
I'm sorry, he always looked like a moron. But
like
anyway.
Moron. That's a fair point.
Actually, no, I have a quote where he didn't look like a moron once, but that's about it. So this is going to be fun to watch. I'm enjoying it. I do hope. I think we talked last week or a couple of weeks ago about the problems with the splintering of the OS. I don't understand why Google doesn't just say, okay, everybody Froyo now. But I guess they can't control the carriers to keep them to allow that to happen.
Yeah, and they haven't released officially a Froyo version for tablets. So Samsung have taken Froyo and made it work on a tablet, but Samsung did that.
Oh, but they can, because it's open source.
They can because it's open source, but the question is, what kind of changes do they have to make? What happens if there's some sort of major security problem in Froyo and, you know, the canonical version of Froyo gets updated? How quickly can Samsung take those updates and merge them into their Frankenstein Froyo for the Galaxy Tab?
But just think, if iOS was open source, we could have 4.0 on the iPhone, on the iPad. We could have folders right now. I want
that. Yeah, but we get splintering of the OS, and we get a lot of downsides, too.
I know, but I still want it. I don't want to wait till November.
Well, the beta's out if you want to pay your $99 and join the developer program. I know a lot of people who are running it already.
Yeah.
It has a whole list of known issues. I wouldn't run it if you paid me.
I still want it.
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, yeah. Totally.
Well, we better wind this up so we can go get medicated again. And we may have to do some dodging around next week, depending on what's going on. If nothing else, I would probably have to record on Sunday instead of Saturday, because I'm going to be speaking at the Orange County Macintosh Users Group next Saturday.
Ooh, that sounds like fun.
So if anybody's interested in getting the details on that, I should have been smarter to look up the URL for it right now. But it's kind of a fun story. A guy I used to work with more than 20 years ago, 1989. Is that 20 years ago? Yeah, it's 21 years ago. Hey, subtraction is not my forte. We've talked about new math before. Anyway, Greg Locke was a friend of mine that I used to work with, who was a hardcore Mac head, and he quit the company 20 years ago. And he saw me talking to Steve Jobs in the All Things D video, and he hunted me down and said, hey, you want to come talk at our user group? So I'm pretty excited about that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. If nothing else, getting to see Greg will be fun. And now I just got to think about what I'm going to talk about.
Cool. So you're going to be there in person. You're not beaming in over
stuff
like telly or anything.
Yeah, I'm going to be actually in person. We talked about doing it because I thought it was at 8 o'clock in the morning. It's down an hour away or more. But I was able to we talked about it, and it turned out I was going to be at 10:30 or something like that. So I think I can pull that off.
Well, but sounds like fun.
That will mess up our talk on next week.
Yeah, well, I'll be flexible. We'll figure something out.
Sounds good. All right, Bart, I guess we'll get together with you next week then.
We will indeed. In the meantime, get well soon.
Thank you. Until then,
happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind things up for this week. Let's do it again next week, shall we? In the meantime, send in your dumb questions to allison@podfeet.com. And I promise to not make you wait 10 months for an answer like I did David. You can also join the live show each week by going to podfeet.com/live and join in the chat with all the other lovely Nocilla castaways. To hold you over during the week, follow my nonsense on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.